Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Kiese Lehman, author of Heavy, an American memoir. Kiese Lehman is a Jackson, Mississippi native, born and raised. Now he's the Ottilie Schillig Professor in English and Creative Writing at the University of Mississippi. He's the author of the novel Long Division and the essay collection How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America. Today we're talking about his new memoir, surely one of the best books of this or any year. It's called Heavy, an American Memoir. Kiese Lehman, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for wanting to talk to me.
You know, I've read this book twice, and I cannot quit thinking about you. It's an amazing book that's concerned with very heavy things. Violence, sexual and otherwise, the weight of language and history, as well as the weight of a human body. So how did all those things come together for you over the time it took to write this book?
That's a great question. Initially, I think I just wanted to do a book for all of those subjects you just named. And then at some point, I was just like, you know what? All of these deserve to be in one book instead of looking at them as singular expressions or singular experiences. And I just wanted to write an honest book, actually, to my mom. And in order to write an honest book to my mother, I just had to braid all of those things you just named together. And after I did it and I showed it to her and she told me what I could keep and what I couldn't, I just decided to show the world.
That's a very brave thing to do. I mean, you know, putting yourself out there is really, in this kind of way, is really an amazing right. act of vulnerability.
You know, again, I was raised by a young black woman who was a sophomore at Jackson State when she had me. And like most parents and children, you know, we lied to each other, we fought with each other, we disagreed a lot. But at the end of the day, I'm still her son, you know, which means that I do have her fire. I think I have her courage, and I have her desire to kind of use the page to figure things out that I can't figure out without it.
I know. I never really know what I think until I write it down. You know,
yeah,
it sounds like you're the same way. Now, I wish you'd talk a little bit about the sexual violence in this book. This is very much a book of this moment when we're thinking about that and talking about it. And there are moments here when you're a witness to it. There are other moments when you're a victim of it. Was it hard for you to find the language to talk about this?
It was hard to find the language, but I think the moment and the movement encouraged the language, meaning that what I really wanted to do in that book ultimately was show that all of these experiences, particularly of children surviving sexual violence or being harmed by sexual violence, aren't solitary moments, right? Like, you know, when things are happening to my body, you know, things are happening in my state around mass eviction and mass incarceration. When things are happening to my other friends, you know, a lot of things are happening at once. So I think sometimes when we think about sexual violence, we just think about it as if it's the only thing that those vulnerable bodies are experiencing, and that just wasn't my experience at all. And I just really wanted to write into, like, that the real scariness of it is that, like, for example, I heard one of my friends get sexually violated by three older boys, young men, and I saw another one of my friends get sexually violated, and when it happened, I felt different things about both of those experiences. But one of the things I definitely felt was I just wondered why the people who sexually violated those friends did not pick me. And I just needed to write that out in order to reckon with it at the time, you know. And I thought they didn't pick me to touch me in that very terrible way because I was fat and unattractive and all these other things. And I just was never able to articulate that until I really decided to write this book.
Now, this may sound like a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So did you talk to survivors, or do you feel like you were talking to yourself when you were writing about this?
I talked to a number of survivors. I talked to a number of people in that book. And ultimately, it's a book written to my mother and written to myself. But again, I don't think I could have written the book had I not had those conversations mm-hmm. with people I knew about their experiences with sexual violence.
This is one of the most honest books I've ever read. I mean, you're so revealing about your eating habits, your reading habits, the good things you do, the bad things you do. And did you ever think, I've gone too far. I've said too much. I can't imagine what that felt like writing it.
Yeah, but you know what? It's weird. It's just like I just finally accept that I'm a writer. So I'm not sure what going too far actually means for me. I know I did not want to hurt people with this book. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know that I didn't, because, like, I can say everything I want to say about me or what I experienced, what I didn't experience, or what I did and didn't do. But I didn't want to harm any other people, especially people who had already been harmed. And mm-hmm. so sometimes that makes it hard, too. Do you know what I mean? So
sure.
I tried as best as I could to be as multidimensional with all the people in the book. I didn't want to make anybody in the book pure evil. But again, you know, I don't know if I succeeded at that.
Let's talk about gender for just a little bit, because this is not a book that's just for male readers. This is a book for everyone. And in that way, I think writing is like the love you talk about as a teenager, that kind of experimentation. You have this beautiful passage. We played with boys and girls, but in the dark of those hallways and closets, sometimes folk would touch each other in ways they'd never touch each other when the lights were on. I was too afraid to touch anyone, but not too afraid to want to be touched. My body didn't care if the person touching me was a boy or a girl. My body felt grateful for tender touch, no matter where it came from. Around the same time, girls and girls' bodies and girls' booties and girls' touch made me feel not just special, but sexier and more beautiful than boys' touch and boys' booties. I didn't know why, and I wasn't sure how to use words to explain it. I feel like that kind of desperation for a touch and affection is universal.
I absolutely agree. And if I'm wrong, I hope I'm right. I just think sometimes, and I'm not the first person to say this, but especially kids just long to be touched, you know, because mm-hmm. there's so many things in the world that are telling you that you're untouchable, like you're unlikable, or, we always talk about beauty, but we don't really think and talk enough about the way I think gender and race and class impact and complexion impact the way we feel ugly. Mm-hmm. And I think for people who feel ugly or lonely, particularly, that touch, particularly when you're young, just feels like salvation.
Right.
The sad thing is what I'm trying to show in that book is that, you know, often that touch is terror. You know,
right.
Even if it doesn't feel necessarily terrifying because you are being touched, the terrifying reverberations of it last a lifetime.
And so much of that is the vulnerability of the young, don't you think?
Absolutely.
You know, we're so tender at that particular age. But I also think all that kind of energy is tied up with writing as well.
Yes, yes.
You know, so talk a little bit about that for me.
Well, you know, again, this book is really about failed conversations with my mother. So when all of these things were happening to me, like what I really needed was somebody to talk to. And I couldn't really talk to friends about that. I didn't have the language. I couldn't talk to my teachers about it because that was just something I'd never seen modeled in schools.
Mm-hmm.
So the person that I thought I should have talked to all of this with all of this stuff about was my mother. You know, she had me when she was young. She wasn't as old as many of the parents of my friends, but we couldn't talk. So I just tried to start. I remember I started trying to write through it at age 12.
Right.
And I showed what I wrote to my grandmother because she was really the person in my life who was just like the best at loving. And I just thought if I could write it to her the way I was feeling it, that she would, you know, deliver me and make me feel okay or tell me something. But, you know, she at the time was like a 50-something-year-old woman dealing with her own memories of trauma. And she mm-hmm. just didn't know what to do when her 12-year-old grandson is showing her things that might have happened to her, might have been what he's seen. You know, but writing, attempting to write it was my attempt at getting free. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to say throughout the book, right? Like, just writing it down gives us an opportunity to free ourselves from these traumatic memories and free ourselves, but it's not enough often. You know, it's the beginning, and I don't know if we can get any place without the writing. Yeah. But in my experience, it wasn't enough.
Now, I love you talk about how this is a book about failed conversations, and I love the way you talk about it as a failed weight loss story. You know,
oh, yeah.
It's just, you did not write a lie.
Most weight loss stories are, right?
Yeah, just most honest ones anyway.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's a never-ending struggle, that is, but it begins in hope, just as your story ends in hope. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I was a big kid. I played a lot of sports, and then at some point in college, because I just had no control over anything, including my environment, I just was like, all I can control is my body. So I obsessively started to starve myself. I started working out obsessively. I was always an athlete, but I started pushing my body until it, like, pained that I never felt before. And, you know, during that time, the world started to treat me a little differently, right? Like, uh-huh. The world was like, you know, you might be a threat, but you're an attractive threat, so we'll treat you a little different. And I, you know, I kept that up for about, 12, 13 years until I got to the point where I had about 2% body fat, and I was fainting all of the time because
yeah.
I didn't give myself enough nutrients. I would run myself into the ground. And one of the things I'm trying to show in that book is that, like, heaviness is not something that we should necessarily try to evade. We shouldn't be trying to run away from weight necessarily, right? Because I think we live in this world where we believe, like, the lighter you are, the healthier you are, and if the healthier you are, the smarter you are, and if the smarter you are, the more innocent you are. I don't believe any of that. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to be this person who believes that there's, like, virtue necessarily in being humongous and not being able to walk. But I definitely don't think there's virtue either in trying to make yourself disappear. And I just wanted to be able to say that in a book because I don't read that enough, especially in books written by men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think women, thankfully, have been trying to talk and write and deal with the politics of bodies forever. And I learned a lot from a lot of those writers and a lot of those people. But I just wanted to write our own version of that, influenced by a lot of these women writers that I've read.
Well, that's why I think this book is so important, because it's such a memoir of the Black body in America and expectations, violations, just the concern of your mother and grandmother, both, who are always after you about losing weight. It's almost as if your body is yourself to some people for a time.
Yeah, I mean, I just think we do sometimes what we're given permission to do and what's modeled. And I feel like from my mother, definitely, and from my grandmama to a lesser extent, they thought loving me was telling me to avoid the police and telling me
yes.
and telling me to lose weight, right? So, like, that was one of the ways that they expressed love, and it's still one of the ways my mother expresses love to me. Key, watch out for the police. Key, don't drink Coke today. Don't eat any sugar. Watch out for carbohydrates. I appreciate all of that, but my concern is that there are other things we're not talking about. Like, mm-hmm. those conversations about food and police are so important, but they sometimes become a proxy for other things that we're not talking
yeah.
about. And so I wanted to write a book about those things.
And even language, when she tells you not to use contractions.
Oh, yeah.
With the police.
Absolutely. My mother, I mean, and you have to understand where such concern comes from. You know, my mother today, if my mother had her way, I would walk out of the house in a three-piece suit. I would sit upright. I would never use contractions. If people saw me reading a book, they would see me reading something like Hemingway or maybe Faulkner. And that's cool, but that's just not who I am, right? Like,
right.
I read all of Hemingway. I read all of Faulkner, and mm-hmm. I decide to write a different way. You know what I mean? And suits look good on some people, and maybe they look good on me, but I'm a camouflage shorts and T-shirt dude. Like, that's who I am.
Right.
And I also think it's important for Black men like me to show other Black people and the world that we can be loving and tender and caring and thoughtful in camouflage shorts and a T-shirt. I think this mask of respectability has, like, longer tentacles than we actually believe.
Right. And it's a way of caring for yourself and being who you
Absolutely.
Are, you know?
Absolutely.
Now, one of the things I love most about this book, I mean, this is the reading life, right? It's that reading and writing and revising are central to this memoir. You grew up in a house filled with books, And your mother and grandmother were pretty serious taskmasters. I mean, they made you write essays and besides your schoolwork, in addition to them.
Yeah.
So you never had any doubt about whether you could become a writer.
Right. I mean, that's what I think is really important for me to articulate. I don't know if other people felt this way, but because I had to read so many books, that meant that there were tons of books that I did not like. So I was never under the illusion that, like, books had to be good.
And
I thought I can write a bad book, you know, like, I can write bad paragraphs because most of the books that I read weren't necessarily great to me. So I didn't necessarily revere books or paragraphs or sentences the way a lot of other people did, for better or worse. But what I did revere was like books that sounded like books that like sounded oral. Books that I could have read, I wish that I could have read with my friends when we were younger, and I wish we could have passed them around the way we passed around music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't see many books like that, and that's what I wanted to write as a kid. And I just didn't know. I didn't have necessary permission, so I just had to write the books that I wished that I could read as a child. I just had to end up writing those books myself, for myself.
Well, there is a wonderful moment when you come home to a new set of encyclopedias. I remember that moment in my own childhood. So this was before the internet. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. I teach now. And so it's amazing. You know, you're teaching kids who grew up with the internet, right? Like that's where we are now. Like kids who I'm teaching in college grew up with the internet. But I'm just, you know, sometimes I'm like, that's amazing. But other times I'm like, oh, y'all don't know what it's like to see a brand new, shiny, glowy set of blue encyclopedias in a house. Like that was, I mean, for my mother, that was the greatest thing that she could ever have done
right.
for me. And she remembers it being the greatest thing her grandmother could do. And I remember my friend, you know, other thing I'm trying to say in this book is that, like, you know, even just because I read a lot and wrote a lot, I wasn't the best writer of all my friends. I wasn't the most voracious reader. I had a friend named Sean Bowser who would come over to my house not to play Atari, but he just would come over to my house because we had the new encyclopedias.
Aww.
He just wanted to look through all of the encyclopedias. And I was like, man, come on, let's go outside. He'd be like, hold on. So, yeah, like that was a moment, you know what I mean? And I feel like my generation was the end of that moment, right? Like the generation after us, they have a lot of other things, wonderfully, but they don't have that. They don't have that thing.
I love in the acknowledgments to your book when you say thank you to the inventors of the internet. You done good.
Oh,
it was perfect. Oh, man. Now, along the reading and writing way, two Louisiana writers were very important to you. And I wonder if you'd like to say a few words about Jerry Ward and Yusuf Kominyaka.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'll start with Yusuf. So I got kicked out of Millsaps College for taking a library book out of the library. At the time, I just had no idea where I was going to go next. Jerry Ward was teaching at Tougaloo at the time, and Jerry Ward was like, you need to apply to Oberlin College. I hadn't even heard of Oberlin. He was like, that's a school who will accept you because of the situation, circumstances in which you got kicked out of school, not in spite of those circumstances.
Right.
And then he said, and plus you get to work with Calvin. And he also said at the time, Bell Hooks was up there. So I'd been reading Bell Hooks. I hadn't read Calvin. So when I got up to Oberlin, Bell Hooks was about to leave, but Calvin was there. He took me under his wing. He taught me a lot about the importance of people who identified as men, really, really necessarily reading a lot of black women writers and thinking about the way that gender impacts a lot of what we do and how we do it. And so when I was about to apply to school, Calvin was like, you should apply to Indiana University because that's where Yusuf is. And I said, Yusuf who? And he just sucked his teeth and he was just like, I can't believe you don't know who Yusuf is, right? So then he gave me a few of Yusuf's poems, and I was like, oh, my God. And I was like, okay, I want to apply. And I was just applying to PhD schools. I didn't even know you could get an MFA. I didn't know what MFA was.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, you know, you're applying to PhD school in Indiana. Apply to MFA school because, you know, Yusuf is there, and you seem to love his work. So I applied there because Yusuf was there. But little did I know, they were just dangling Yusuf out there because Yusuf had technically left a year before. So when I accepted, I thought I was going to work with Yusuf, but then when I got there, they were like, oh, sad to tell you, Yusuf left a year ago. He's just still on our catalog. So.
But you had read the work.
Oh, my God.
And the work had mattered.
And the work mattered. The work mattered.
And we should say that was Calvin Herndon you were talking about.
Yes, Calvin Herndon.
Because he was a very important writer in your life, as was Margaret Walker, of course.
yeah, Margaret Walker's work was important, but Margaret Walker, the woman and like the actual human being, was so important. My mother, you know, was working on a project with Margaret before Margaret passed, and so we would always go to her house. And again, I didn't understand how important she was. I didn't understand how important the Black Arts Movement was. I didn't understand that the Black Arts Movement was really what I had been looking for as a writer in high school. But, you know, Margaret just had sat me down one day, and she had a real talk with me. And she was just like, you know, you got to rethink this whole audience. You got to write to and for your people. And I didn't understand that. And it took me a few years to understand it until I got kicked out of school. And then when I understood it, I felt like a door had been open that had sort of been open the whole time. I just wouldn't look in it, you know.
Well, and it's also a responsibility you have to choose to assume. You know, she was offering you that mantle and saying, pick it up.
That's
you know?
Right. I didn't have the imagination or like the self-confidence to see it that way, but that's exactly what she was doing. I remember telling her, I'm going to Millsaps to play ball. You know, she was trying to talk to me about writing, and she was like, oh my God, this boy talking about playing ball. I'm talking about art. You know, like, I feel like she knew the gift she was given. I just didn't understand it at the time, but thankfully I...
Now you do. Now, in addition to being very much a book of this moment, this memoir, looking at your particular past, seems a natural outgrowth of the essays in How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America. So you're looking back. You end up in the present with something incredibly relevant. But you're also writing toward a future in which things are different. And I wonder how different you feel about yourself after writing this book. So much of those last few pages is written in the future tense.
Right. I'm just someone who's obsessed with what people now call futures and past, and the way like those past and those futures meet. And again, because my mother is my mother, I think she's really obsessed with like this sort of conventional notion of progress. And what I wanted readers at the end of that book to understand is that, like, yeah, like, I want progress, too. I believe in futures, wholly, but I'm completely suspicious of futures that aren't honest about the past. I mean, Long Division is really about that, too. And I just wanted people to know that, like, we have sort of been encouraged to not be the best and to be abusive and to be harmful and to not communicate, but collectively, we really don't have to be this way. Do you know what I mean? Like, if that sentence in and of itself is a sentence that looks future. Like, we don't have to. We can individually, collectively push back and fight and use different assemblages of words to create different futures for ourselves. But those assemblages of words have to reckon with where we've been. And that's what I wanted folks to understand. That's why I was playing with tense. All throughout the book, I'm playing with tenses. And at the end, I just wanted to make it sort of plain as possible in that last little section.
Well, it was beautiful, just as this whole book is beautiful and important.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Kiese Lehman about his new book, Heavy, an American memoir. You can meet him when he appears in conversation with Maurice Carlos Ruffin and signs his book Thursday, October 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Kiese, thank you so much for talking with me.
I'm so thankful for this interview. Thank you for taking the work seriously. I'll talk to you soon.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Le Petit Theater is partnering with Octavia Books for a book club to be hosted by Christina Pellegrini, and including special guests from each production. The first meeting is Sunday, October 14th at 1 at Le Petit Theater, and the book for discussion is Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong by Terry Teachout. Poet Melinda Palacio reads from Bird Forgiveness, Sunday, October 14th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Bonnie Morris signs The Feminist Revolution, The Struggle for Women's Liberation, Sunday, October 14th at 4 at Octavia Books. C. Morgan Babb signs the paperback of The Floating World and appears in conversation with Ann Gisselson, author of The Futilitarians, Tuesday, October 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. April Irving signs her memoir, The Gospel of Trees, and appears in conversation with Lavinia Spaulding, Tuesday, October 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Anne Boyd Rue, author of Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters, leads a two-part reading and discussion of Little Women, beginning Tuesday, October 16th at 6 at the Mid-City Branch Library in New Orleans. Newbery Award-winning children's book author Catherine Lasky signs the books in her Bears of the Ice series, The Den of the Cubs and The Quest of the Forest Forever, Wednesday, October 17th at 4:30 at Octavia Books. New Orleans 300 presents Maurice Ruffin discussing ancestral suits, the life of Petrina, wild queen of the Red Hawk Hunters, the first woman to lead a Mardi Gras Indian tribe, Wednesday at 6 at the New Orleans Main Library, 219 Loyola Avenue. Kiese Lehman signs Heavy, an American memoir, and appears in conversation with Maurice Ruffin, Thursday, October 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Ken Foster and photographer Treyer Scott discuss and sign City of Dogs, New York Dogs, Their Neighborhoods, and the People Who Love Them, Thursday, October 18th at 7 at Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Former Congressman Bob Livingston discusses and signs The Windmill Chaser, Triumphs and Less in American Politics, Friday, October 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Florence Dorr signs Novel Sounds, Southern Fiction in the Age of Rock and Roll, Friday, October 19th at 6:30 at Octavia Books. Elizabeth DeSimone, an instructor in the Jefferson Parish Library's Internet Technology Group and a creative writer herself, discusses tech tools for writers, Saturday, October 20th at 11 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This presentation is part of the regularly scheduled meeting of the South Louisiana Chapter of Romance Writers of America, open to the public. Annie Lamott discusses and signs her book, Almost Everything, Notes on Hope, at St. Charles Avenue Baptist Church, 7100 St. Charles Avenue, Saturday, October 20th at 6:30. This is a ticketed event. Tickets include a signed copy of the book and are available at octaviabooks.com or eventbrite.com. The Friends of the Jefferson Published Library will conduct its semi-annual Big Book Sale from Thursday, October 18th to Sunday, October 21st at the Pontchartrain Center, 4545 Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are 10 to 8 Thursday through Saturday, October 18th to 20th, and noon to 5 Sunday, October 21st. Proceeds benefit the Jefferson Parish Library. The Louisiana Book Festival is coming up November 10th on the grounds of the State Capitol in Baton Rouge, with a full day's programming with Louisiana writers. An important offering is a series of workshops for aspiring writers at the State Library, Friday, November 9th, with such well-known writers as Suzanne Hudson and Joe Formicella, Josh Wheeler, Jonathan Evison, and Tessa Fontaine. Sign up now as these fill up quickly. For information about fees and registration, go to louisianabookfestival.org. The festival is also looking for volunteers. Check out the website for info. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.